Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Side Hustles and Stuff Podcast, episode 51. Keishi, do we have any meanings for the number 51? 51 is what you get when you add 50 plus 1. 51 is one more than the 50 states of the United States of America.
51 is the natural number following 50 and preceding 52, according to Wikipedia. It's also the atomic number of antimony. I never heard of that element. Have you heard of that?
Antimony?
Yeah.
Is it?
So, Area 51.
Oh, yeah. Oh, how could we forget that? I guess I'm not up on my alien conspiracy theories.
Somebody made us forget without us knowing how.
And 51 is also an odd number. So, there's the Wikipedia thing. Oh, yeah. And, you know, to bring it back to the states, there will be the 51st state in case any state ever be, in case the United States of America gets a new state. But until then, it's 50.
So then maybe Washington, D.C. or something.
Yeah. But until then, that's it. All right. So what are we talking about today? I think the biggest topic is how to get things done, how to stay committed. It's probably the most important part of this podcast today, Keishi.
Yeah, I think so. I guess how to stay focused and how to get things done in terms of, I guess a couple of strategies in terms of committing to people and things like that that help you not just forget things and leave them undone.
Yeah.
And we'll also talk a fair bit about books. It's probably the third episode in a row where we talk about books for quite a while.
We can't stop talking about books.
But you can never have enough of books.
Yeah.
We're not sponsored by Ty Lopez.
Nope. So if you have been trying to start a side hustle, if you've been jumping from one idea to the other, starting it, but never actually seeing it through, if you want to finally sit down and get consistent and see your idea go from just starting point until reality, until it actually hits off, check out this podcast. This might be for you.
Yeah. But before we get to it, what are you drinking? Today, I'm drinking decaf green tea. It's not like I don't want caffeine or anything, but I just saw it on the shelf and it looked really nice. So the bottle's pretty nice. And it's made by the same company that I usually drink regular tea from.
Very nice packaging.
Yeah, that's why I bought it.
Did you try it yet or not yet?
Not yet. There's some like tea residue at the bottom. Yeah, or the tea with like the powder or something.
Mm.
Not bad. Tastes like green tea.
5 out of 10?
I guess if 5 is average, then yeah, 5 out of 10.
All right. Then I have my Seto Kazeri, whatever this is. From Ehime, I assume it's some sort of jelly drink. Has nice oranges on the label. Let me try it out. I'm not sure what I bought, but I liked the cover as well. It is indeed jelly. It's kind of thick. Like I think this requires like me squeezing on the bottle to get it to come out, because otherwise it's not going to flow out like actual liquid.
Yeah, that's what I find interesting about those, because I had the Mitsuya cider jelly.
Yeah,
it was even more interesting because it was actually sparkling and jelly, so you were supposed to mix it before drinking, but then it's sparkling, so I guess if you mix it too much, then it's gonna
blow up.
Yeah,
that would be an interesting case if, like, because these are carbonated jelly drinks, but we know how carbonated water kind of works if you shake it up, but what about carbonated jelly? Mine tastes pretty good.
Nice. Yeah, I guess it's an area known for its oranges, would be my guess. For its mandarin oranges.
Is it mandarin, what I'm drinking? Because I see no indication of what it is exactly, unless I'm missing it somewhere.
I think so, but I'm not sure.
Okay, I don't see orangey anywhere. Or maybe, all right. Yeah, and the other one is the Gerold Steiner sparkling water that I have. Yeah, and I prefer regular sparkling water to like flavored, unless it's lemon.
Yeah.
Podcast, I said that. I'm shifting from coffee to sparkling water. And I know I said carbonated drinks. Carbonated drinks equals soda for anyone else listening. And soda is not exactly a good substitute. A terrible substitute. And so I prefer these. Like, they don't taste quite awesome, but there's that stinging, I guess, that I like. And similarly with lemon flavored or lime flavored, it doesn't taste sweet. It tastes like a challenge. That's how I call it. It tastes like a challenge. Maybe that's why people like to drink hard alcohol. They're like, oh, yeah, that's the good stuff, because it burns their throat and it tastes like crap. Maybe it's the same kind of rationale.
Yeah. So I guess you're on a mission to try all the different sparkling waters. You have to have like Perrier and what else is there? All those sort of brands.
But I don't know where they would sell them. And actually, I don't know if there's an actual difference between brands, because if it's just sparkling unflavored water, I'd imagine it's all the same.
I think now you insulted all the sparkling water fans. Oh, well. All the mineral water fans that can tell the difference between like a source in the French Alps and a source in the Japanese Alps or whatever.
to that I say, I'm willing to learn from your expertise, and please provide us with sources to learn from otherwise, because, you know, that's the thing, I'll admit, like, my taste buds are not very sophisticated. Like, you know how people can talk about food all day long and they can talk about all the little nuances that they taste?
Yeah.
For me, it's like, well, up until now, and for most of my young life, you could say, I categorize things under two labels. It either tastes good or it doesn't.
No, exactly. And I don't know if we were just chatting about this a few times and kind of off the record or on this podcast, but like I was saying, for my aviation website, like, I had reviews of different flights and stuff like that, right? And it's like, I read some of those reviews on the internet, and it's like, oh, the whatever flavor of the chicken was amazing, and it was tender and whatever. And then I read some of my reviews, and it's like,
it was good.
All right. So there was chicken and there was beef. I chose the chicken, and it tastes pretty good.
Yeah, it tastes. I mean, what else do you want?
Yeah, exactly. And it's like,
I am honestly, you know, I'm jealous, and I look up to people that are able to describe food and all the little senses and nuances and textures and intricate detail, because clearly they probably have a much more sensitive palate, and they have a much more broader vocabulary to talk about these things, whereas I don't.
Yeah, exactly. I have a friend that he contributed a couple of articles to my blog, and also like me, he just likes trying different airlines and different products and stuff like that. Like, every time I read his stuff, I was like, wow, it's like, it's such a colorful description of the food. And in my case, it's always like, all right, it was pretty good. The dessert was good. The soup was good. Whatever was good. I didn't like the beef, and that's it. It's like, oh, maybe I'm just not sophisticated enough, or it's like, whatever. It either tastes good and I enjoy it, or it tastes bad.
I think some people, myself included, would appreciate such a review, because it just tells us things in a very simple manner. It's either is good or it's not, and that's all we kind of want to know. Yeah, it's good. You should try it. I'm like, all right.
Yeah. The other thing is like, when people fly long haul business class or whatever, they like enjoy different wines and stuff like that, and you read the reviews and as well, and it's always like, oh, there was Dom Perignon whatever 2007 or whatever.
Yeah.
And like, whenever I take business class, I'm like, all right, can I have a can of Coke? And like, one time I remember a flight attendant came and she's like, do you want some wine? I'm like, no, can I have some Coke? And she brings me the Coke and she's like, are you sure you don't want any wine? And I'm like, no. And I'm like, I'm probably the least demanding passenger they ever encounter. It's like,
yeah. Well, you know, but maybe through all your years of drinking Coke, maybe you can sense the little nuances inside Coke. Like, maybe you can taste the metal of the can in which it was in.
I don't know. Definitely the one from cans and from glass bottles is better than from plastic bottles. But
That's true.
But yeah, I'm very simple when it comes to food.
Well, you can make it a goal to write really vivid descriptions of the food that you eat. Like, you know, the chicken was very moist and the herbs.
I'm not even sure I want to write it. Like, I think there's an extent where it just sounds pretentious in a way. Like, just eat your goddamn chicken and enjoy it. Rather than like,
I imagine you 20 years from now sitting with your family at a dinner table eating chicken, and your son or daughter proceeds to describe how great the chicken is, where you just say, just eat your goddamn chicken and enjoy it. I don't want to hear that.
No, but I mean, yeah, like I enjoy nice food, and I think I can definitely tell the difference between like an $80 steak and like a $15 steak. But at the same time, I can describe the difference. I can just tell that, all right, this thing tastes really good.
Yeah.
And the $15 steak tastes okay, or tastes just fine. Like, definitely can tell the difference, but like, don't really know how to describe it.
The one thing that I still don't quite get, you know, like, if you ever take a look at Instagram.
Yeah.
People take pictures of their food, especially like at fancy restaurants, and it's like a huge, well, not, it's not a huge, it's like a clean white plate with just a little bit of like some little piece of thing, a little piece of sauce, and then like a green leaf.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is that all? Won't you go? That's kind of where I draw my limit. Like, maybe they eat it for the presentation, maybe there's a subtle taste, but these little small artisan type dishes with just like a one piece of leaf and a sauce and maybe, I don't know, like a inch of meat, I don't quite get. Because, like, if I'm hungry, if I'm still hungry, I'm not going to be very happy.
Yeah, you're just like, give me my Burger King. Give me my Burger King.
Yeah, after those kind of situations, you kind of have to go take, you know, make a quick stop at a konbini or something and buy some extra sandwiches just to fill up, because the expensive dinner that you had didn't quite fill you up.
Yeah, it's interesting because I enjoy nice meals every now and then, but then if I don't think I would enjoy them if I had to eat them every day. It's like most of the time, just give me a burger or give me a piece of chicken or something, and I'll eat it and I'll get full. But every now and then, I think like nice course meals and stuff like that's nice.
I guess part of it is like, you know, here I am talking from the caveman perspective that I am. part of it is indeed the experience of it, the dining experience, the atmosphere, the type of food, the selection, the pairing and everything. So yeah, it's like, it's probably like a all-around experience that someone can enjoy, whereas for someone else, they just want to eat food and like feel full. So I guess it's just different types of preferences.
Yeah, I think so. And when it comes to experience, I think there's nothing better than like sitting on an airplane and eating your meal and watching the scenery and pass by. And especially like some business class products have backward facing seats, so you're kind of facing against the direction of travel, like you would on a train.
Okay.
And I think that then it's even better. It's like you're kind of watching the engine and you're watching the land pass by you, and you're having a nice dinner or a nice lunch.
Are the windows any better in the business class or the first class?
No, but you have like two or three of them, so you get to see more.
Okay. Because of course, obviously, I've only flown economy class.
You need to get better at using your miles, I guess.
Is there like a resource you can point me to? knaviation.net?
Yeah, that's one place, I guess. There's also a bunch of different blogs that you can find. But yeah, it's interesting because, again, like I guess if you're paying with credit cards and stuff like that and just collect points along the way, it's not too difficult to fly business class every now and then.
Would you be surprised to learn that I don't have a credit card?
I think some personal finance experts would be proud. I would say you should get one. But again, I also know that it's pretty hard in Japan for foreigners to get any sort of credit, I think.
Yeah, that's probably the one major reason why I never actually went about to getting it. I know it's possible and it's doable through some companies or some banks, but because like you immediately know as a foreigner, there's like an extra, I guess, layer of complexity involved simply because you're a foreigner, whether it's you have to fill out more forms or they just don't trust you as much.
Yeah,
you're not gonna be motivated to do it or get it done, as opposed to like I imagine in America, you just they mail you like, hey, apply for this credit card, get X points or something like that, and just fill it out, and there you have your own credit card.
Yeah, I think America's exceptional, whether in the good or bad way, in terms of this. But yeah, I know in Japan as a foreigner, at least from what I heard, it can be pretty challenging to even open a bank account. And we're not even talking about credit here. We're just talking about a place to get payments to.
So. Mizuho was pretty like a long ordeal, I think 2 or 3 hours. With Shinsei, I remember Shinsei was the first bank that I used when I came to Japan. And they're pretty foreigner friendly. I'm pretty sure I got it done under an hour. But Mizuho, there was a whole lot of forms. It was done all in Japanese. And I guess they also wanted my social security number, which was odd. Because to communicate back to the United States, I guess, that I have an account here. I mean, I have to disclose accounts anyway. So, but I thought it was still a little odd.
The United States is special, I guess, because they tax people on their foreign income, even if they're non-residents and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Uncle Sam has far-reaching arms, I guess.
Yeah. I have to file every year. So, I mean, you don't have to pay, but you have to file. Like, if you earn under X amount, then you don't really have... The only thing you're paying for, really, is the filing.
Yeah. It's still a hassle. It's like,
it is. I think... I think if you are just working like a regular job and you don't have any side hustles, probably TurboTax or whatever software out there will make it simple enough for you to do it. And maybe you'll just pay the, what is it? I don't know, 50 or 100 bucks, however much TurboTax charges.
Yeah.
I mean, how good TurboTax is a whole other story. But like, that's just the simplest route.
Yeah.
Once you have like a side hustle, I think it's better to talk to an accountant, because there isn't exactly like a way inside TurboTax to say, hey, I'm doing this as a side hustle, and how do I file it the right way? So I filed in the past through TurboTax, and I ended up paying quite a bit of money. And remember, once I got an accountant, and he's like, yeah, you overpaid. So we refiled for a certain year, and I got some cash back, which is nice.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Taxes are a pain.
Yeah. By the way, did you get your letters yet for the Japanese taxes? Because I haven't got mine. I haven't gotten mine yet.
No, I think they usually come in June or something. Because, the national tax you pay when you file So you file and you pay. So I guess you already paid that.
Yeah.
And as I think I mentioned too that I overpaid by like $200 or $300 or something. Because I did a stupid mistake, and I guess this is a disclaimer for anybody that's trying to file taxes, whether in Japan or overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I did the tax return, but before actually printing it out and checking everything, I paid the amount that the tax return spit out.
Hmm.
And then I realized I forgot to put in like $2,000 worth of, or $1,000 or whatever worth of social security payment. Yeah.
No.
So, so I overpaid, but
it's a small lesson, small price.
Yeah. I think I could apply for, I could revise it and get the money back, but.
Is it worth? Well, I mean, I guess it's a question of, do you want the $200 back? Is it worth the effort?
I don't know. I think when you imagine all the hassle that you have to go through, like redoing the forms and sending it in and so on, I don't think so, but maybe one day.
Yeah. Maybe like 10 years later when you're a little bored and you have nothing to do, you're like, what can I do today? I know.
Yeah. I'll email the Japanese Prime Minister. Like, hey, remember that time when I gave you a tip?
I need that back now with interest.
It's time to pay back. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, did you pay right after you file? And then for I think the local tax and health insurance.
Yeah.
I think all that comes in like June or something.
Okay. Because I get the local tax that I have to pay, and then there is the prepayments for next year that I do, and those come twice a year. I have to pay those twice a year. I think at the end of July and like at the end or at the start of November.
Yeah, I wonder how the prepayments work, whether it's something that the accountant needs to apply for, or if they just decide to send them to you or something.
I think it's just a case of if you earn more, I guess if you have more profits than expenses. I'm not sure why or how or what the reasoning behind that is. Like in the case of doing online side hustles, obviously, you know, a website, it's only going to cost like $100 a month or so.
Yeah.
So, and if you're earning more, you know, obviously you can have like a great disparity between how much you earn versus how much you're spending actually.
Yeah.
On your expenses. I think that's the case here. But I'm not quite sure why. I think that was what my accountant said. But having said that, I think it's definitely better. I'd rather do the prepayment than like pay a giant, massive chunk in one shot, because it feels a little easier to pay, you know, like three times. And then it's three times. It's the two prepayments, and then there's the one that you pay when you file.
Yeah, I can understand it. I think that goes kind of back to what we were talking about before on one of the episodes, like set the money for the tax aside because it's not your money anyways.
Yeah.
And I guess the sooner you get it out of your account,
the better.
The better anyway, yeah. Yeah, I started just because I guess over the last couple of years, the amount of taxes has gone up a fair bit that I have to pay. So I started putting them in my, as I mentioned, I'm tracking my net worth every month.
Mm-hmm.
So I made an estimated tax liability line. So now I know that even if whatever I have X amount in the bank account and in cash, then really what I have is X minus the tax liability line.
Yeah, that's always a good thing to know because you don't want to mess up there.
Yeah, exactly. Especially when it starts getting into higher amounts.
Yeah, because that's when, and again, that's why I prefer the prepayments, because I don't have to pay as high of an amount.
Yeah.
So what do you want to talk about today?
Today's a goal episode, no?
No. We still have, it's only the 30th. There's a 31st. So I still have, we both of us still have 2 days to knock out our goals. Oh, the goal will be next week.
Oh, okay. I was under the impression we're doing goals because the next week is too late. But yeah, that makes sense because otherwise we're kind of in the middle.
I mean, unless you hit your goals already, because I still have a few articles to publish and a few articles that haven't come in yet.
I haven't hit any. I hit one goal.
Okay.
Or two. Okay. In that case, so have you been reading anything recently? I think we talked about my books last week fairly extensively, but how about you?
I have been reading one book on the secret on the download that I haven't been talking to anyone about.
All right. I guess it's time to reveal the secret.
Yeah. It's called Coding for Humans. And the only reason I found it was like, I don't know. I think one of the Twitter accounts that I follow, Nat Eliason or something, or Eliason, I forget.
Oh, yeah.
I think he made a post once where he asked his followers to promote their products and courses and whatnot. And one of, like, you know, I was just, you know, I guess it's much more interesting to see, like, see these people like pitch their own stuff and see if there's anything that you like in there.
Yeah.
And I saw this one person was promoting the book Coding for Humans, which was his own book. I think he's probably still a college CS student. So I was curious to learn about it. So I bought the book and I have one more chapter to go through. But I don't know, like it was interesting because I've always in the back of my mind, I know that, you know, if you want to be an entrepreneur, or if you want to be a side hustler or anything, one of that, not necessary, but it's preferable that you know how to build.
Yeah.
Because builders are essentially creators. And of course, there's the whole selling aspect, and a salesman can easily just be a founder, if anything, if he's, but like, you also need the building aspect. But that aside, I was always kind of curious as to, well, in my mind, I know I already laid this out, that I know I don't want to like code full time forever, and I'm not a programmer, and I'm not sure if I want to do that.
Yeah,
like I kind of lined that out, and so like as a result, but I still have kind of an interest, like, oh, what if I could do this? And every time I kind of tried it, just never worked out, and I never stuck with it. I don't know. So it's kind of like this kind of like back and forth kind of, I hate it, but I like it, and I'm kind of interested, but I don't want to do it. But it would be curious to find out how it works. You know, so I'm kind of like, it's like a seesaw between these very attitudes that I feel towards it.
Yeah.
So I bought the book, and yeah, so it just teaches the Swift language for iOS. So you would learn how to build apps, but I don't think, maybe it's too beginner level. I don't think I'm going to walk away from this, like literally creating my own app, but I think it was still very interesting.
Yeah. I think it's good to know basics of programming. Like, again, like in our high school, we had an IT class, and programming was a big part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's not like I can code anything like complex or stuff like that, but still, just being able to understand how computer code works, I guess, one thing. And the other thing is, like, if you know the basics, like the kind of like the if-then statements and the different types of loops and like variables and stuff like that, you realize that everything in life is essentially a programming problem.
Yeah.
And I think it helps put structure around problems, and even outside of programming. It's like, if you can just identify what repeats, what needs to be done multiple times in the same way and stuff like that, I think it can just make you a more efficient person overall.
I think the interesting part in like trying all of these things, whether they last or not, is that it kind of gives you a new mind frame or view to look from.
Yeah.
Because obviously programmers think much differently than, say, marketing people or salespeople.
Yeah, I think so.
But I also do think that, you know, they're quite smarter in their own way. So I'm always like kind of looking, probably another reason why I wanted to pick up the book, just to like understand that mind frame.
Yeah, I think it's very like, especially with simple programming, it's all very, I guess, fixed and set. There's no kind of ambiguity.
Yeah.
Which I think is nice sometimes.
Yeah, that's, for a beginner, that's critical, because there's plenty of topics where you start learning, you realize there's a lot of ambiguity, which obviously a beginner wants a clear set of rules to follow, just don't grasp their mind. But if you throw too much complexities at them, they're going to fall off. It's like, I guess, learning a language, you know, like there's a lot of language, of course, consists of rules, but a lot of rules aren't exactly strict.
Yeah.
And there's always millions of exceptions. And if you like jump in as a beginner and then like you're learning these rules, and at the same time you start realizing there's a whole lot of exceptions, it's going to stop your progress, because it's overwhelming.
Yeah.
So I think, yeah, those exceptions and ambiguity should be saved for later.
Yeah, I think so. And so do you have any plans to try to get to the point where you can build something, or is it more just, again, kind of getting into the mindset and understanding how it works on kind of the basic level, or what is the end game, I guess?
I'm not sure. That's a great question. I'm not sure what the end game is. The end game is to finish the book, and then from there, decide the next goal. Because, again, looking at the chapters right now, you know, chapter 2 is why Swift, chapter 3 is getting an environment set up. Chapter 4 is variables. Chapter 5 is conditionals. Chapter 6 is encouragement. Chapter 7 is arrays. Chapter 8 is loops. Chapter 9 is functions. And then chapter 10 is like conclusion and where to go from here. Probably that's where I'll go and pick where to go from here. If anything, I don't know, I would be down for like a version 2 of this book. I've had thoughts about like iOS apps before, and I wouldn't mind building something, but like right now I have no idea what I would even build in the first place. I'm filing this under stuff to do for curiosity rather than like stuff to do for action.
That's interesting. So I guess that's one of the kind of two types of reading that you do, right? For curiosity and more for kind of immediate action.
Yeah. So yeah, because like I don't have an immediate playground or channel to play with this stuff, and I'm not quite ready to do so just yet. So that's why I file it under just learning for curiosity and for fun.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, again, we also talked about books the last time, but I guess the more I think about it, the more I think that there's very few books that you can actually apply immediately, I think, because nowadays if you need to apply something like right away, then you just go to Google or YouTube and you search for it.
Yeah.
Right? So I think most reading is more for kind of, it's like, is it either for entertainment or for kind of longer term development that might not have any explicit benefits right away.
Or general awareness.
Or general awareness, yeah. And yeah, I mean, looking at my bookshelf now, I think there's very few books that I can point to that had like very solid kind of immediate tangible impact on what I've been doing.
Yeah.
But then again, I think there's a lot of books that that nonetheless shaped the way I think and shaped the way I do things and so on over the long term. Like one of the few books that that I think had more of an immediate impact is, for example, The E-Myth and I guess Profit First. Those are two that I kind of to an extent implemented right away. But other than that, it's really more about just enjoying the reading and then kind of remembering the stories.
It's the stories, actually. I think some of the best books I've read are all stories, because stories are much more easier to remember, and like stories you get inspired by, and stories kind of drive your behavior.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true or not, but much easier to read a story than like of someone else and what they did, rather than like a how-to book.
Yeah.
Or a theory book. But yeah,
exactly.
One of the things I particularly like about this book, and I wish kind of all books had this, was, you know, each chapter ends with like some practice problems. Now, I know that, you know, it's not a lot of writers, when they sit down, they just want to tell their story. they don't want to provide like a exercise section at the end to confirm that the reader understood what they were talking about. But I really, really, really appreciate it. Maybe that's why I also like that Logical Fallacies book, because it was a half work book. Part, you know, like, I think the more and more I think about it, learning is like, you know, 50%, probably less, but to keep it simple, 50% input and 50% output. Because like acquiring or accepting the information is the first part.
Yeah.
But a lot of us kind of confuse that as, oh, I read this, so I learn it. But then there's still the practice part. And so more and more I'm becoming convinced that, like, you know, learning, or not learning, but when, you know, when people say they've learned something, I don't quite trust it until it's like a reflex. At that point, you could say this person has learned it and it's been ingrained into them. Like, for example, if you read that, you should, if a ball is thrown at you, you should catch it. You'd be like, oh, I learned that today. But if I throw a ball at you and it hits you in the head and you don't catch it, I'd be like, well, did you really learn it then?
Yeah, no, I absolutely. I think so. And I guess thinking about that, it's almost like whatever you read, it's just something that helps you form a hypothesis. But unless you actually go out there and put it into practice, then you're just somebody that knows but not necessarily understands. And I think you see this a lot where people just talk about different things. And I mean, yeah. I guess every now and then we're guilty of that too, I think. But
I think, well, I all of us are guilty. The thing is, it's hard, because here's why I think it's hard. I think in successful learning, the teacher, whoever's teaching you, they must be able to bridge the gap from where they are to where you are. Meaning they need to understand what your current level of knowledge and awareness is before they try and teach you stuff. So that way, once they get to the complex stuff, you're already on board with them, right?
Yeah.
So I think language schools probably do this best, where you do like an assessment level check before you actually get assigned to a class, so that they know what your experience is and they could put you in a proper class. But overall, I think it's hard, or probably close to near impossible, for an author, unless they're really writing in simple terms, to bridge that gap to a reader. So like, because the gap will always exist between where you are in terms of your abilities and your knowledge versus where the author is, because that gap exists, not everyone is going to try and cross that gap. Because, like, you know, most of us just read to read. We don't read and then take action, or we don't see reading as, we only see reading as 100% reading. Nowadays, I'm thinking, like, for everything that I read, like, the session should just not be about reading. The session should be like 50% of the time should be spent reading, and then 50% of the time should be spent thinking about what I just read and or practicing what I just read.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Although I think it's really hard to implement, because again, it's like, I think in the moment when you read it, you feel like you understand it. So it might feel redundant or like a waste of time to kind of slow down and try to process it, because again, it's still fresh in your mind. But then I think a day later, like you were saying about the what was it, the forgetting curve or whatever,
yeah, you forget like 70%.
Yeah, exactly. A day later you realize you haven't even remembered anything out of what you read. So so definitely I think it's beneficial if you somehow interact with whatever it is that you learn. Although again, I think like you're saying, it's easier for some things than for others in a way.
Yeah,
because again, with like language, for example, it's very clear what the path is, right? And there's kind of a fixed body of knowledge that you're trying to acquire, and you're kind of going towards that. Yeah. And again, it goes back to some of the things that you were talking about, how to learn well from based on the course that you took. It's like, it's easy to have some sort of roadmap, right?
Yeah.
But I feel like with a lot of the books that we read, language aside and language, math, programming, and so on aside, like it's really hard to have that kind of roadmap. It's like what is really the roadmap if you're trying to learn about business?
Yeah.
With accounting, sure, you learn about accounts receivable, you learn about balance sheet, income statement, whatever. It's kind of very, I guess, scientific in a way.
But when
you get more into kind of the business in general, then yeah. So I think it's easier with kind of language books and science and things like that, where it's kind of easy to define the roadmap.
Mm-hmm.
But I also feel like it's more difficult with more vague, or I don't know how you would call them. Yeah, I guess vague or topics that don't really have clear boundaries, like business, for example, or again, like if you're reading biology or something, but just for fun, not to become a zoologist or something, right?
Yeah, I really think it should be on the author to provide that, just for like better understanding. I don't know, I going through all of these books and like just remembering how little I remember. And like when I retain, it's usually through practice. I really wish that authors or publishing companies put like some effort into that side, like maybe add questions at the end or outlines. Like the one thing I really liked about the course, the How to Learn course, was that every section started with here's what you're gonna learn, and it's like an outline of you're gonna learn X, Y, Z, A, B, C, blah, blah, blah. Then you go through those lessons, and then there's the final lesson where it's like, here's what you learned. I mean, a quick recap: X is blah, blah, blah; Y is blah, blah, blah; Z is blah, blah, blah. So it's like it's that repetition. It's really good for you.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn on that though, because like I read somewhere that reading books is like having conversations with the greatest minds in the world, essentially.
Yeah.
Right? And that kind of brings me to like, does every book or even most books need to teach you something explicitly? Because again,
no.
I feel like it's kind of the nudges that it gives you in the direction that your life in general is heading.
Yeah, I think it wouldn't make sense for like biographies and just general stories,
yeah.
But like the nonfiction stuff of like where the book is trying to teach you stuff, that's where I think it makes the most sense.
Yeah, I think so. But then again, nonfiction is a lot of nonfiction is just generalized BS. That's like, yeah, sure, it's easy to say it, but it's much more difficult to implement it. And then I think there's like really, again, I've never read this book, but based on what I've heard, and it's like there's books like I Will Teach You to Be Rich, which is much more practical and kind of action oriented,
yeah,
and which I think kind of fits the conditions you were just talking about. And I'm not sure if it has any exercise or whatever, but I think it clearly outlines the steps in terms of what you should do.
Yeah, it definitely outlines the steps, and I think that's where I think that's what makes this book much more valuable, because it's much more action oriented and tells you the specific steps of like, you know, open a credit card. If you're paying fees, call your bank and say this script. Blah blah blah. If you're gonna open up a long term investing account, open only these accounts. If you want to play around with your money, open this kind of account. And at the end of the chapter, like, just open this account again. If you're so-and-so, do this. If you're so-and-so, do that. And just in case of when you're trying to learn stuff and like take action on stuff, I think this stuff is very critical. Whether it's, if you're learning for biology, whether programming, whether science or like analytical thinking, statistics, blah, 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 all of that stuff. Of course, it would not make sense in a biography or where the author is just trying to offload his thoughts on the world, and he's not trying to exactly teach you. He just wants to ramble on and on. In that case, yeah, it's not important. But I think everything else where, it's like, for example, Factfulness, that book could have definitely used some problems and exercises at the end, in my opinion, as well as the repetition.
Yeah. And I guess it also comes down to like, what is the goal of the book? Like, I don't think the goal of Factfulness was to teach people how to necessarily, I guess the goal was to teach people to identify the different kind of fallacies that we see in the world. But I think it also was just kind of to open your eyes in terms of, yeah, the world is not as bad as it seems on the surface.
Yeah.
So perhaps on the different types of, because it's been a while since I read it, but I believe it was structured in a way where each chapter was presenting kind of different type of fallacy, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So perhaps you're right. Perhaps it could have had some sort of exercises or something where you could learn to recognize those more actively, I guess.
At the very least, I think, the author can set aside, say, 20 minutes to an hour and come up with a list of 50 questions and send it to the publisher, and they could sell that separately for $5 or $10 and more money to them.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I think there are some third-party companies that do like, I'm not sure if they do questions, but there's companies that do summaries and stuff like that. But
yeah,
maybe there's a business there. Maybe there's a business in creating questions about books or kind of, it's almost like, I don't know again, coming back to what we were talking before, I don't know how high school works in America, but in Slovakia, whether it's high school or perhaps middle school, like you read something and you're supposed to understand it, not just have read it, and there's like questions about it on the test and stuff like that.
Yeah, we have that.
Yeah, I would guess so. And so maybe there's some business model there, like the Spark Notes, but not Spark Notes, but Spark Questions or whatever.
Yeah, to spark your brain. So if someone's looking for a business idea, here it is. Well, I don't know if it's a profitable one. It's probably that's the next challenge to find out.
I don't know. Yeah.
But I would pay for something like that. Like if I read a book and I really liked it and I wanted it to stick and I wanted to like apply what I learned, I would pay for that easily.
Yeah. Have you ever been part of a book club or something like that where you and somebody else reads the same book at the same time and then kind of spend time discussing it?
I have not been. Plus it's Corona time, I guess. It's
yeah, I guess you could do it virtually. But I guess that could work as well, right? It's like you read it and then you kind of interact with it. Because I think that's what it comes down to at the end of the day. It's like interacting with the information rather than just consuming it.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Maybe we should try that. Maybe we should pick one book and then discuss it here on the podcast.
Okay.
Let's see what the learnings are.
Okay. What kind of book do you want to do?
It's a good question. Let's do... Well, maybe we should do Factfulness.
Oh, hell no. I mean, it was a good book, but I kind of... this is one of those books I gum on through, that Japanese word of like patience and persevere. Like part of it I liked, but it was also a bit of a... What's the word? Let me Google it and see if I know the right word. Trudge, yes, trudge is the word. Walk slowly with heavy steps, typically because of exhaustion or harsh conditions. I trudged through the book.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, let's give it some thought and let's decide on something. Because right now I'm reading the book about SpaceX, as I was mentioning. It's pretty fun.
Okay.
It's exciting. But yeah, I think it would be a fun experiment to see. Because I also think like, different people get different things out of books.
Yeah.
And it might be interesting to see like, all right, you read chapter one, I read chapter one, and maybe the conclusion you come to or the main learning you come to is like completely different from the one that I come up with. And it might be interesting.
Yeah, well, I'm down for that. Let's come up with a book by next week. We'll have to go through Amazon, and we could it'll make sense on next week's episode as part of the goals.
Oh yeah, all right. So it's a commitment. It's a deal.
Exactly. What about on your end? Anything new?
Yeah. So as I said, I'm reading the book by I forgot who wrote it, but essentially it's about the first few years of SpaceX, about the first few flights,
yeah,
and how they were scrambling to build a rocket that actually flies and reaches into the orbit. It's really amazing. It's like again, I think say what you want about Elon Musk, and I know he has fans and he has people that don't like him. I guess just like every semi-famous or famous person does.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think what he's done at the company and like I guess it's his hustle and like work ethic and just being able to lead by example in a way that got him where he is. And like one of the things that I found interesting is, and sometimes I kind of feel the same way, is like he was trying to hire the chief engineer, but then he couldn't find anybody good enough,
mm-hmm.
or he couldn't find anybody great. So then it's like, rather than settling for some mediocre person, he just decided to be the chief engineer.
Oh, wow. And how did that end up?
Well, I'd say it ended up pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And
pretty fascinating, yeah.
Yeah, or stuff like there's been private rocket companies for ages, right? But none of them really made it into the mainstream, just because like we were talking the last time, there's like Lockheed and there's Boeing and stuff like that. And like there's these large incumbents that are essentially treated preferentially when it comes to government business, because they're big military contractors and the government likes working with them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what caused a lot of the rocket companies to go out of business, because unless you get a government contract or something, you're going to run out of money eventually, right?
Yeah, because the stuff is too expensive.
Yeah, and similar thing with SpaceX, other than Elon decided to sue the government, right? And he won, because again, the government, there was some contract for, I don't know if it was for delivering cargo to the ISS, which is what they've done with the Dragon capsule, mm-hmm. or whatever it was, but essentially the government awarded the contract to either Boeing or Lockheed, I think. And he just didn't like it. He's like, yeah, we didn't even have a chance to compete, even though by that time they were already kind of a rocket company and they didn't fly it into the orbit, but they already built a rocket.
Yeah.
So he went and he complained, and I think essentially he sued the government and said the process was unfair and SpaceX should have had a chance to compete for the contract.
Mm-hmm.
And lo and behold, he got a ruling in his favor, and there was a new competition and SpaceX won, and they got like $300 million or whatever out of that at the $300 million contract, which is what essentially made the company in the beginning, right? Because otherwise they would have run out of money. Even though by that time Musk was pretty rich, it's still pretty easy to run out of money when you're trying to reach the space.
Yeah.
So it's a really good story, and I recommend the book.
I might have to pick that up.
Yeah, definitely. It's a good read.
The whole part, like you said, like, you know, about them getting the rockets done, right?
Yeah.
One thought that struck me was like, you know, it's amazing what people can do when under time and pressure and like actual motivation. It kind of makes me think of the whole, you know, COVID vaccine also. It's like, you know, amazing how within a year or probably less, I don't know what the time frame was, but like, it's amazing when you get a fire burning on, under your butt. It's amazing what you can do.
Yeah, definitely. And it's almost like the Parkinson's law on a grand scale. It's like, and I guess economics also play a role in this case, but yeah, it's like, unless there's some sense of urgency, then
nothing is
then you're not really in a hurry.
Yeah. You know, I urgency is such a powerful motivator. You know, that's why just urgency and limitations, I think, are powerful motivators. I used to go to the gym, the sports center nearby, and it closes at like at 10 o'clock. You know, to most people, that is not ideal because they want to go whenever they want. But
yeah,
I always liked it because I don't want to be at the gym at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night. And I don't want to reach that point where I'm there at night because it's going to affect my morning. So it forces me to like get my other things in order, to make sure that I leave on time, I get there on time. And so like it kind of forces you to hurry up. It sets an urgency for you to do these things.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because if you think about it, it's also like it's a similar situation with living in a city versus traveling to a city. It's like like we live in Tokyo, and I haven't been at the Tokyo Tower, for example. I know you went pretty recently, but I haven't been there for, I think, more than a decade.
Yeah.
And with like these things, it's like, oh, I live here, so I can go there anytime. But anytime means never a lot of the time, right?
Yeah.
Versus like
Anytime Fitness.
Yeah, exactly. Versus like if you live in whatever, Osaka, and you come to Tokyo for a couple of days, then whatever you want to see, you definitely go see, because you're kind of time constrained, and there's this sense of urgency and a fear of missing out in a way.
Yeah.
Versus like, I guess the same with the gym that you were saying, is like, oh, I can go to gym anytime because it's open 24/7, 365.
Yeah.
Which also means that you can keep pushing things back and back and back, and there's always going to be the next possible time.
Yeah.
Which makes it, yeah, which makes the fact that it's open 24/7, 365 pointless, because you never end up going there.
Yeah. It's also like if things are available all the time constantly, I guess you don't value them as much. Or like if they're available on a limited basis, then obviously it carries much more value because you can't get it all the time.
I think definitely urgency, and then also commitments to other people are good drivers. Like, for example, here I know that every Sunday, more or less every Sunday at 3 p.m., it's like I got to be in front of my computer and we got to be recording this.
Yeah.
Or like with, for example, I was saying that I'm going to start a new site, and like I was kind of planning it slowly and like taking it slow and making some progress here and there, but not really moving things forward.
Mm-hmm.
But then one day I just decided, all right, I'm going to post a job post on Upwork to find a writer for the site. And I've got like a dozen applications or something, and I decided to do test articles with 5 writers.
Yeah.
And at that point, I suddenly have commitments to other people. So now I got to move things forward, or I'm going to disappoint other people that maybe are waiting for more work in terms of writing more articles or whatever it might be.
That's a great point. Commitments to other people. You know, it almost makes me think like, you know, it's hard to get stuff done on your own. You can get stuff done on your own, but it's hard, right? But if you have a team of people that you pay, I guess that's how all businesses work, essentially. You know, you have the CEO or the shareholders of the company who pay you to get what they want done, right? This is essentially how it works.
Yeah.
And but without the kind of the structure, if you don't have that structure in place of having commitments to other people and answering to them, there's not really much that drives you unless you're just really special and you can motivate yourself. And I don't imagine 95 or 99% of the population is like that. So I think that's like a very powerful motivator to have. Like, it suddenly makes a lot more sense that if you want to get good at X, then you should find out who you can commit to that aligns with X. Like, I don't know, with fitness, obviously you'd probably hire a personal trainer. Now you have a commitment. With a language, you hire a tutor. Now you have a commitment. You know, with a podcast, you hire an audio guy, or do it with a friend. Now you have a commitment.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it comes back to what we're talking about. It's like, I don't think I would have started this podcast on my own. And even if I started, I wouldn't have probably stuck with it for more than 4 or 5 episodes.
Yeah.
And probably the same for you. But if there's the commitment to each other, then that makes it really easy to stick to it.
Kind of makes you think where else that you want to get results in, where else could this be applied? On my end, some of my nice to haves are obviously language, the long-term investment stuff. You know, after reading Ramit Sethi's book, I think IDACO would be my best approach right now anyway.
Yeah, if you're so in Japan.
Yeah. So, yeah, I guess it just makes a lot more sense to involve people in what you want to do. Because if it's all by yourself, you're not going to get stuff done unless it's a literal pain shooting down your leg. Then you're going to go and run to the doctor. But you don't want to be in a position where you're just reacting to pain all the time, right? You don't want to go on the offense when... Well, you're not exactly going on the offense. You're going on the defense.
Yeah.
You don't want to be pursuing things just as a result because they came around and something started hurting. You want to pursue things while you're still healthy and you're free to do them rather than reacting to the pain that comes through, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, this reminds me of, for quite a while, I was actually thinking of joining tennis classes or something.
Yeah.
Just to get some sort of exercise. Maybe I should look for that.
I think so, yeah. And you could... start a website about tennis and then that it's a tax write-off.
Yeah, sounds pretty competitive though.
Oh, damn.
I gotta stop starting things because, again, too many things. It's hard.
Well, you know, think about it. There's how many websites that you have going on right now?
I don't even want to think of it.
That you're consistently publishing or they're just existing and they're profiting?
I guess 5. So yeah, one's not making any money, but I'm publishing and it's still pretty young, so it's not meant to make money, although it would be nice, certainly. And then I have a couple of others that are making money and that I'm publishing also. So yeah, a few. And I guess it's always a balance between just being too focused and then that one thing exploding and you being completely screwed.
Yeah.
Or being too thin.
Yeah, that's another issue of spreading yourself too far and wide. But the reason I'm asking is because, there's a matter of fact that you're keeping 5 sites afloat and putting work into them for how long has it been now? Then there's the podcast. So it's the reason why I bring this up is that it's important, I guess, to get a reality check that you are indeed not only starting stuff, but you're sticking with stuff. It's just some things are a little harder to stick with. But the reason why I say this is it kind of gives me the confidence, by the way, I was able to do X, Y, and Z and stick with it, and I'm still sticking with it. Well, it tells me that I'm not a complete failure. Then I can probably succeed with this, just because I have a track record. That's the see. Remember when we talk about books and mean like not being able to throw aside a book,
yeah,
not finish it. It's because I have that kind of part. I guess maybe it's part of my personality. Want to see things through. Although yeah. I mean, obviously, you shouldn't apply rules black and white. You should apply them where they make sense. But it's kind of within my personality to see myself as someone that gets things done and sees them through. Looking back at that track record, it kind of gives me confidence. If I was able to do this, this, and this, then there's no reason why I can't do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Not to tap myself on the head or anything, but I guess, yeah, this podcast, we stuck with it for over a year now, and counting, same with my other sites, I guess all of them are. Well, one is older than a year. The youngest one is older than a year, I guess.
That's quite a long time. Think about all the side hustlers that had a project that they started and didn't last a month.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I guess if I look back, because again, when I was just starting with this sort of stuff, I would buy a domain, I would publish 2 articles, and I would kind of call it a day.
Yeah.
And yeah, so I think it's just me kind of thinking back to that period where I truly would kind of jump from thing to thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess now if I look at it, yeah, I think you bring up a good point. And I think it's also, again, it's also the fact that for some of the websites I have, or for most of the websites I have, other people doing the work. So it's, again, I can only have 24 hours in a day. But if you hire 2 writers, then you have 72 hours at your disposal, or whatever 24 times 3 is.
Yeah.
I hope I'm getting my math right.
Well, if you don't get your math right, whoever's listening, feel free to chime in. Yeah. And leave us a bad testimonial on Apple on Apple Podcasts.
Yeah, so yeah, I guess all in all, it's good then.
Yeah. And your YouTube channel, as far as I understand, you're on your 4th episode, right?
Yes, I think I published 4 videos, but one of them is just a repost from my previous aviation channel.
Yeah, but it sounds like a month to me. Well,
so I created 3 new videos, and I publish every Saturday, so yeah, I stuck with it for a month so far, and it's fun. I've been enjoying recording the videos and the editing. Yeah, not so much, but it's still doable. And
imagine you could get to a point where I don't know if it's possible to get to such a point where you can record it and you speak perfectly and nothing requires editing.
Yeah, I think before that I'll get to the point where I just hire somebody to do the editing. Yeah. But yeah, it's fun project, and somehow I find it easier because, as you know, and as we talked about on this podcast, I have a personal blog where every now and then I publish something related to business or just life in general, kind of stuff, and you have your own as well,
yeah,
and I think both of us are not posting there perhaps as often as we would like to.
I posted yesterday. Yeah, but yeah, you're right.
Yeah, you're doing much better than I am in that regard. But just recording these videos on kind of the topics that I was originally thinking of covering on the personal blog,
mm-hmm.
somehow I'm just finding it easier to talk about them than to write an article. So
I think, well, here's a question. Well, not a question, but a thought. I was going to ask a question, but my thought is that you have a certain approach to the way you do articles. Whereas when I like, and I would do a similar approach too. Like if I was trying to rank, if I was trying to like make sure I was found on Google and write in a certain way and blah, blah, blah. But with the post that I made yesterday, it was more so like my own personal thoughts that I just want to get out on paper. And that's it. I'm not exactly looking to profit or rank or whatever. I just want to put it out and publish it and like maybe come back to it later and review it. So like, I think the approach is maybe different.
Yeah, it's interesting though, because I think in my case, it might be the other way around. Because again, on my personal blog, it wasn't meant to be SEO optimized or anything. It was more just like a brain dump.
Yeah.
But then I felt, maybe I felt like if I try to dump the brain, essentially what I was trying to do was write as I would talk, right?
Yeah.
But then maybe that's what sounded weird to me, because I'm so used to the kind of to building SEO sites.
Yeah.
Versus if I'm talking on video, which is, yeah, I'm talking like I talk.
Because when I look at your personal blog posts, they don't look like a brain dump. They look like a very well-structured article that someone put a lot of thought into.
Well, yeah, I'm of the opinion that even they're not really SEO optimized though, because I'm of the opinion that every writing should be pretty well-structured.
Mm.
Even if
I mean, I think it's okay to do bad work, but yeah,
but yeah, there's definitely something that I don't know. I just for some reason I just find it easier to record a video on a topic than to write an article, which is interesting because I would never have guessed that about myself.
Okay,
but we'll have to see. Like if I get to stick with this for a year, then I can.
You can put me on the show too. Get me some clout and exposure.
Yeah, I will. Once I have like a, like what, 15 subscribers.
you got to do those videos. Every time you reach a milestone, like 50 subscribers, 100 subscribers, 200 subscribers.
Yeah,
like, giveaways or something.
yeah, but I think that, like the one thing that I guess I'm struggling with the YouTube channel in a way is that I can't decide what to focus it on, because again, my interests are kind of wide, and also the stuff that I do is kind of pretty wide ranging.
Yeah.
But I guess, yeah, for now, the goal is to just get to like 50 videos or 100 videos and not even really care about that.
Yeah.
Just to kind of build the habit and then I can see it and I guess assess.
Your videos are also like, the last one was like close to 20 minutes, right?
Yeah. Then one was like 19 minutes. I don't even know how it got that long.
Yeah. I was thinking like, what if you just do like 5 or 6 minute or 7 minute videos max? I think it's a lot more manageable. And maybe you could save some content for later for another video and you could stretch some things out.
Yeah, I think it depends on the type of video, because like last time I was talking about the different types of pricing structures you can use as a freelancer.
Yeah.
And again, I think for those, it's really important to go over all of them kind of in one video, just summarize them, and just ended up being 20 minutes, which again, I think it's long, but if somebody wants to learn about the topic, then I think if they don't spend 20 minutes learning about it, then why even learn it? Because it's amazing how short attention spans people have nowadays.
Well, I think that's been the case throughout history.
I guess, yeah.
It's funny, like I every time someone mentions that, I can like think back to like, I forget which philosophy book I was reading or psychology book I was reading. I guess like back in like the Socratic times, or you know, Socrates and Plato and blah blah blah, they also complained of short attention spans. And like in the case of like, you know, newspapers and whatnot. Well, I'm sure newspapers are still around, but like, you know, I don't know, like there was books, there was an issue of books, there was an issue of radio, there was an issue with TV was around. Like there was always that complaint of like men's attention spans are getting shorter and shorter. And I think, yeah, it's true. And there maybe like it went down from like 4 seconds to 2 seconds to 3 seconds. But I feel like it's always been an issue. But because it's always been an issue, at the same time, anyone that cares enough to listen, they're going to listen. I feel like it's also a similar issue, not issue, but a case with copywriting. There's a whole, you know, should copy be long or short? And the answer is always depends.
Yeah, I feel like the problem, though, it's a two-sided problem, right? It's like the demand side is, I want more content because my attention span is short. And then there's the supply side of, you can have more content because, like, I'm sure Plato or whatever, like you said, was observing the same thing. But then again, like in ancient Greece, you couldn't just go on YouTube and watch anything like with the touch of your fingertip.
Yeah.
Like you had to go to the library or whatever.
They had actual tablets of stone.
Yeah, they had real tablets, not iPads. And whereas now it's like you watch something for 2 minutes, you get bored with it, you just have the next thing.
Yeah.
Like, right on your screen, and which is amazing, but at the same time, I think it makes the barrier of entry low, but it also makes the barrier of quitting really low.
Yeah, but I don't think that should stop you exactly, because the point I was trying to make was like the interested party will always, like, copywriting is, you know, you're always told to write for one person specifically.
Yeah,
you know. And whoever that, you know, if it's valuable to the person, people will read ads. If it's valuable enough to them, they will read it. If it's geared and structured towards them, they will read it. You know, if you're in pain and you have an itch that you need to scratch, you will read an article on like how to fix the itch.
Yeah, I think the other solution to that is watching videos at like 1.7 times or double speed.
Yeah.
This is the other thing, is like, I don't know when, but at some point I started watching videos at like 1.5 or 1.75 times the original speed.
Yeah.
And like now when I listen to something at 1x, it just feels so slow.
You guys are so slow. What's going on? Netflix has that. You can watch movies at 1.5.
Yeah. TV shows, I don't know. I mean, they're meant for entertainment and just sit back and relax. But like,
yeah.
But like if you're trying to learn something or whatever and you just want the factual information, then yeah, just play it at 1.75x. Yeah, the other thing that I wanted to mention is that recently I stopped taking my cell phone into the bedroom, or we stopped taking cell phones into the bedroom.
Does that work?
It makes it so much easier to fall asleep because I guess if it's out of reach, you don't reach for it.
Yeah.
So every day before going to sleep, I just leave my cell phone on the kitchen table. Because like otherwise I would just lie in the bed and scroll through Facebook or whatever. And, I guess both the light is not really good for it, right? The blue light or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And also just the distraction of not being able to fall asleep.
Yeah. And having it there. And you know that it's there, so you reach for it.
Yeah, exactly. So just leaving the phone on the kitchen table and then reading before bed, I think it's really nice. It's really nice sleeping pill.
How do you wake up? Wait, no. What about the alarm? Do you have like a separate alarm clock?
Yeah, so my girlfriend wakes up before me usually, so I just kind of follow.
Okay.
Follow, but we bought a separate alarm clock for that, and then also, but I forget to turn it on every now and then, so it's a hit or miss. And then I also still keep my phone set up, and so now because it rings on the kitchen table instead of right next to my bed, it also makes it, I guess, easier to wake up.
Yeah, so it's a useful life hack, you would say. Has your sleep been bad otherwise, or before when you did it, before you did this?
I don't think it's been bad, but I just, again, like I think at this point in time, pretty much we're all cyborgs in a way, right? It's like the cell phone is the extension of our brain.
Yeah.
And I just feel like, I don't know, again, like I would watch YouTube videos or I would scroll through Facebook or whatever before sleeping. And like it certainly can add a lot of minutes or even dozens of minutes to the time between you deciding to go to sleep and you actually falling asleep, right? Because you kind of lay down and you still play with your phone. It's not like I would sleep bad or whatever, but I just feel better rested now. And also, again, I just find it much easier to fall asleep because there's nothing distracting. Right? It's like lay down, you fall
I should
asleep.
Do that.
Yeah, I think it's, especially as, again, it's like we're all cyborgs, but even cyborgs need to shut down for a while every now and then.
Yeah.
And I feel like as long as the phone is within your reach, within easy reach, like there's something in your brain that tells you that, yeah, there's this other part of your brain that's right next to you. So interact with it. Is like if it's in the kitchen on the table face down, then it's like, all right, it's sleeping and perhaps I should sleep too.
I think maybe there was a study done on this, but I don't know, like if you keep your phone on your desk as you work, the fact that it's there within like your field of view, it takes away from your focus And simply just putting it away somewhere where you can't see it improves your productivity overall.
Yeah, I think I read that. I think it was, I don't know if they were doing tests or something, but one group was allowed to have their phone with them and the other group was supposed to leave it in the other room. And then the group that left their phone in the other room actually performed better. Right?
Yeah. And also probably a lesson for cleaning up your desk as well. Because like if you have more things on your desk, clutter, it's like more visual noise that your brain has to process, where if it's everything nice, everything's nice, clean and tidy, then there's less to look at.
Yeah. Looking around me, I guess there's a lot of clutter. But
well, I'm gonna have to try the sleep thing though and put my phone like on my couch.
Yeah, highly recommended. I don't know if you know this guy called Mark Schuster or whatever his name is pronounced. I think he's like a venture capitalist. I used to read his blog a lot before, but he posted some video about this exact thing, I think, where he stopped taking the phone into his bedroom mm-hmm. and just had some good results. And yeah, we're finding similar results. It's like, again, as long as the phone is there, it kind of is tempting to... again, it's almost like an addiction, I guess, right? It's like we're all addicted to our phones.
You know? Yeah.
And as long as it's outside the room, at least it's out of sight, out of mind.
I think that's a big deal, yeah.
So you should definitely try it. I think even if you feel like you're sleeping well, I think it's gonna be a game changer in a way.
Okay, I'll try it and report next week.
It's cool. Yeah. I think the first day might be difficult. It's like withdrawal symptoms, essentially, right?
I'll be like scratching myself and shaking.
Yeah, exactly.
But switching.
But after a few days, I at least personally, I find it much easier to fall asleep. Because again, I guess in a way, I don't feel like I'm missing out on anything if I fall asleep.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have the phone there, then essentially the entire world is at your fingertips. And,
like I can't miss out on the world right now. Yeah, hold on. Sleep exactly. And wait. There's an article out here. There's a video about cats.
Exactly. So yeah, let us know next week how that went, because we're all right. Curious to see.
Well, we got some assignments, I guess, for next week. There's the goals, there's the book that both of us are going to read, yeah. And then there's the sleeping thing.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. And this has been the Side Hustles and Stuff podcast with Keishin Yuri, episode 51. If you want to check out the show notes for this podcast, go to sidehustlesandstuff.com/E51. Get a link to the books that we were talking about. We talked about a lot of things. Mark Schuster. Yeah. We'll link that in there too. And if you do want to start your own side hustle, check out, again, the show notes. Check out Bluehost, where it's a place where you just can buy your own website and just put your project out and it's into the world. You know, like if you want that commitment, if you want to get things done instead of waiting around, hoping that it'll finally happen one day, you know, make a monetary commitment and that will kind of drive you to get things done. So check out the show notes at sidehustlesandstuff.com/E51. Website makes it real. And that's it for this week.
Talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week. And probably there are no bloopers this time around.
We're too good.
Because just a quick question. I don't see waveforms in Zencastr from my end when I talk. Do you see them for me?
Yeah, I see them. Try again.
Hello, hello, hello. Blah, yeah, blah, blah.
I see them.
Okay, because mine is like straight white. Not straight white, just a straight line. Whereas yours pop up and mine don't.
That's weird. Because on my side, mine's very small.
Okay.
But yours are like full height. So should be fine.
Okay. Well, just wanted to double check. Let me send you the screenshot. That's what I see and what I've been seeing.
That's weird. I can see.
Well, if it's okay on your end, then it's fine. Because you're going to send me the audio anyway.
Yeah.
Editing. All right. Let's edit this out and jump back in.
Yeah, I don't know.
Episode 51. 501. No, not 501.
there's a blooper.